Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. It's a pleasure to introduce really all of our speakers, but we'll start with my classmates in YU. We spent actually, Ricky Weiss and myself, Rabbi Dr. Ricky Weiss and myself spent 4 years together in YU together in Rav Schechter Shir, and I can tell you he was one of the top guys in Shir. Used to sit in the back, used to take notes in the corner of the room, and he also was the gabbai in the minyan YU. That's not in the bio here, and he has a wry sense of humor which he used to use every week when he made the announcements, as I'm sure you'll hear. Today, after YU, he went on to medical school, and he then decided to switch in the rabbinate, in the public rabbinate. Maybe he needs to attend the session on mental health. it's a wonderful switch, and it's really he serves a large congregation in Hillcrest, Queens, and he teaches biology at YU. And really, it's a pleasure to have as all our speakers in it, an MD, a Talmud Chacham, and it's, as a personal friend, it's a pleasure to welcome you, and you'll kick off our morning session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Just to prove Rabbi Kelman's point, actually, it's not rye. I prefer pumpernickel. I want to thank Rabbi Kelman for inviting me. It's my first experience with Torah Motion over the last year since you began these annual conferences, so I appreciate the opportunity and the honor, as well as to thank another classmate of ours, Dr. Gerald Friedman, and all of the staff, Lily back in Toronto, and all the staff who are here, and appreciate all of you who are here as participants, and hope that you're all enjoying your weekend here in Stowe. You can follow along some of what I have to say. Most of what I'm going to share is not necessarily in the handout, but some of it is. It would begin on page 49 in the booklet, the part that I will refer to. But at the moment, I'm going to speak outside of the book. I don't have any PowerPoints. I'm anti-technology. So just to kind of bring balance between Dr. Steinberg's and Dr. Eisenberg's presentations last night, I'm going to avoid that. I don't own a Palm Pilot or a Blueberry or a Blackberry. So it's interesting. As a rabbi, I have to begin with something related to the Parsha. So this week's Parsha is Parsha's Balak. And we know that Bilam was truly one of the supreme Nevi'im, one of the supreme prophets. He had tremendous capacity as a prophet. We read tomorrow morning that he's described by his own words as Shomea Imrekel Yodea Das Elyon. I think that phrase is perhaps a good way to begin this session on mental capacity. Shomea Imrekel, he had the ability to hear and sense the words of God, the Yodea Das Elyon, and to truly have a grasp and an appreciation and a profound understanding of Das Elyon, of the supreme knowledge of God. So that's, I think, relevant for the following reason. I think it's important to, at the outset, state that what we will be talking about in terms of mental capacity, I'm going to kind of substitute a different phrase in just a moment for that, is somewhat technical. It's somewhat subjective to a certain extent as well. It takes a certain amount of capacity on the part of perhaps the psychiatrist to be able to evaluate and assess whether a person does or does not have capacity. It's not an absolute necessarily all the time. There are situations in which it's quite clear, but many situations where it's not quite clear. But most importantly, I think at the outset, just in terms of mindset, that whether a person has greater or lesser mental capacity does not, as I think we would all agree, have any impact upon the kedusha, upon the sanctity that the person has as an individual, as a human, and as a member, perhaps, of the Jewish people. And that's proven by Bilam, because Bilam had tremendous capacity, and clearly we would not consider him to be of the loftiest individuals characterologically, ethically, morally. So having special das, having special mental capacity, does not necessarily translate into being, if you will, a more sanctified person. Just at the outset, a little sermonics, if I may. The term that I'd like to use is a term that's used clinically, and it's the term that's used bioethically, and that is decision-making capacity, DMC. DMC refers to that concept of decision-making capacity, which is not necessarily synonymous with the concept of competence, but just to focus on decision-making capacity. Just want to read to you a very, I think, very succinct and very, I think, clear definition of decision-making capacity. This is found a number of years ago, published in 2001, an article entitled Emergency Determination of Decision-Making Capacity, Balancing Autonomy and Beneficence in the Emergency Department, published in Academic Emergency Medicine. So the authors there use the following, and I think it's very, very useful, even if it's not all-encompassing. They say that decision-making capacity ultimately refers to a patient's ability to make an authentic choice. The ability, the capacity of a person, decision-making, to make an authentic choice, a choice that is not in any way coerced by external or internal factors. Oftentimes, internal factors are more powerful than external factors. And that decision that the person articulates and makes is freely, like bechira chofshis, in a sense, free will, that is based on a person's understanding, comprehension, ability to reason and to rationalize and to make an authentic choice. And the aspects that can affect that are reflected in issues related to cognitive and affective or emotional issues. So, for example, it is certainly very, very common that a person with schizophrenia, and Dr. Friedman can certainly address that more poignantly clinically, but a person with schizophrenia, certainly untreated, can certainly manifest with psychosis and by definition being psychotic, and therefore have certain cognitive impairments that will interfere with their ability to make authentic decisions. Or affective, emotional, a person with a major depressive disorder can, again, not treated effectively, depending on the manifestation of that person's major depression, can, based on emotional internal impairments, also have the inability to make an authentic choice. And I just wanted to outline for you, because I want to talk mostly about the halakhic, but I want to just introduce it with some basic ideas clinically as well. There are different ways to kind of categorize how one is defined or determined to be of decision-making capacity. So there are four, certainly, basic components. Number one is the ability to just receive information. Like Bilam describes, shomea imrekel. First, one has to have a certain sensory capacity to receive information. Whatever sensory modality one uses, whether it's vision, whether it's auditory, whether it's touch, whatever the mechanism or modality, a person has to be able to receive information. It's the second and third that I like to focus on mostly. The second has to do with understanding information and the ability to process that information. And the third, I'm going to put these two together because I'm talking basically primarily about these two middle ones. And the third, in addition to the ability to understand and process information, is the ability to deliberate, the ability to evaluate the information, to weigh it against other values, to make a determination as to what is or what isn't best in this situation. And that concept of being able to reason, to rationalize, to make judgments, that processing, understanding and processing information, and then taking that to the next step of reasoning, rationalizing, evaluating, making judgments. And the fourth is the ability to articulate or to communicate one's decision. I think it's also important to point out that decision-making capacity is not an absolute in the sense that a person either has it or doesn't have it. It is possible for a person to lack decision-making capacity one day and to have decision-making capacity the next day. The Gemara talks about such a concept. The Gemara talks about the halakhic term for someone who lacks decision-making capacity is ashota, which is defined in terms of more descriptively somebody who's a lav bar das. Ashota, which can be defined as Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Farbstein defines him, someone who is psychotic, but it's not exclusive to psychoses, but someone who is ashota lacks decision-making capacity. Because the person is, as the Rishonim explained, a lav bar das. The person doesn't have the das to be able to make decisions properly, and that term das is what I'm going to try to define halakhically for us. But it is possible, the Gemara talks about in Rosh Hashanah, a person is itim cholim, itim shotim. Sometimes the person is fully cognitively and mentally fully capacitated, and sometimes the person is not so. And that at the time that the person is in full, if you will, well-being of their mental capacity and decision-making capacity, they're obligated to mitzvot. And when they are shota, and they are, if you will, psychotic or impaired decision-making capacity, they are exempt from certain mitzvot. And it's also true that it's possible for a person to lack decision-making capacity for one type of decision, but at the same time have the ability to make decisions and have decision-making capacity for a different type of decision, depending on the nature of the decision. So if you have a patient who lacks decision-making capacity, that doesn't mean that it's all-encompassing. It could be that this patient has the ability to make decisions about certain health care considerations about their care, but maybe other decisions they don't have the full capacity to do so. So it's not an all-end-all. Just for example, there was a report I just heard on the radio. I haven't read anything about it the other day, that in the United States, apparently, there are many, many thousands of angioplasties that are performed without being properly indicated. Apparently there are many angioplasties that are done that are perhaps not really necessary. And if you will pardon me for the moment, just to confirm Rabbi Kamos, I guess one could argue that they're done in vain. Go through the femoral vein. Okay. So for example, if a physician is talking to a patient about a proposed angioplasty, so the person has to be able to understand, focusing on understanding and processing information, and being ability to reason and rationalize and evaluate that information. So first, the patient has to be able to understand what is an angioplasty, what will transpire, what is, in a sense, the purpose of it, to open up, let's say, an artery or arteries that are now narrowed and not allowing proper blood flow to the heart, for example. Helps to understand the basics, and then to be able to evaluate in the patient's decision whether to consent or not consent to the procedure, evaluate what are the risks, what are the benefits, what are the consequences if the person chooses not to undergo the angioplasty, what are the alternatives. That's more than just processing information. I understand what you're telling me, but then I have to be able to, if you will, internally deliberate, evaluate it, and therefore come to a decision. Or to take a halakhic example, one of the halakhic arenas in which these issues become relevant, just basically, is in terms of minyan. Last night, Dr. Steinberg was talking about the golem, in terms of whether a golem could be constituted for a minyan. So what if you have somebody who lacks decision-making capacity, depending on their impaired cognitive abilities, whether or not they can count towards a minyan? So you have nine people. We were just talking with Dr. Friedman. I used to be at the West Side Jewish Center in Midtown Manhattan. The pleasure of being there for a number of years. But over the course of time, the demographics there have changed, and there have been times that it wasn't always as easy to get a minyan sometimes on Friday night. So the story goes, I wasn't a witness to this, but the apocryphal story goes that one time someone was outside trying to get a minyan for Friday night. Now I think under Rabbi Herman's doing a little bit better. Nonetheless, apocryphal, that so we would sometimes stand outside and ask, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish to come in for a minyan? So the story goes that someone asked someone, are you Jewish? So the fellow said to him, no, I'm atheist, thank God. So if you want to know whether somebody can count towards a minyan, so what if they lack decision-making capacity? So the first thing is they want the person to count for a minyan, so they have to first understand what that means, that we're going to have a quorum to be able to daven, to be able to say Baruch Hu, Kaddish, Kedusha, just understanding, and you will count towards that, and you will answer Amen, well, that's fine. But what if they understand and process information, but aren't able to then use that information in an evaluative form, or in a deliberating form, meaning they don't understand the consequences, that if they happen to decide not to join, what the consequences are, that this minyan won't be able to say, that somebody perhaps won't be able to say Kaddish if they're in mourning, or what the benefits are of joining the minyan, or what they're all about, that it has to do with some form of religion, it has to do with God, and it has to do with some aspect that is more than just the basic information. So these are examples, in the sense that perhaps parallel. To give you a more specific clinical situation, which happened to come across in an American Family Physician, also from 2001, is the following, very straightforward case that I think exemplifies some of what we're talking about. A 54-year-old woman with a history of diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, and schizophrenia. This is a woman who is now being hospitalized for some medical complications. That's not important for us, but previously she had been hospitalized with diabetic ketoacidosis, meaning that because of her insulin-dependent diabetes, she wasn't taking insulin. And because she wasn't taking insulin, her blood sugar is skyrocketed and the metabolism started to break down molecules into ketones and ketoacids, which caused an acidosis, diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a potentially life-threatening condition and reason, one of the important reasons for hospitalizations of diabetics. So why did she not take her insulin? So the reason was because she reported that voices told her to stop taking her insulin. So the question was, now in this new hospitalization, is she of decision-making capacity to make decisions about other aspects of her care? That was the case. It's interesting, just parenthetically, and I think that there's some validity to this. We know the Gemara says that ein mashgichin bebaskol, that we do not use halachically heavenly voices to determine halachic decisions, like the machlokas between Hillel and Shammai. Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, there was baskol that said, we don't follow main mashgichim bebaskol, according to one opinion in the Gemara, that you can't use baskol, heavenly voice. So the basic understanding of that is, the lo bashamayim hi, that Torah is not based on what happens in heaven, it originates from heaven, but it's really man's prerogative and proprietary rights, if you will, to determine halacha. But it could be that implicit in that Gemara is this notion as well, meaning that when you make halachic decisions, they have to be rational. They have to be deliberate. They have to have a certain reasoning behind them. And to use a baskol, to use a heavenly voice, I'm not talking about God explicitly speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu, for example, that's not a baskol. But a heavenly voice, even if it has validity, is not a rational way to arrive at halachic decisions. So perhaps implied in that concept of baskol nigmar is an idea that kind of reflects a little bit of someone who has a psychotic event where they hear voices that tell them to stop taking insulin, which is clearly irrational and unreasonable. So the question was whether a person like that has decision-making capacity. That's part one. Part two of three parts of my presentation has to do with, well, whether in terms of, from a Jewish halachic perspective, whether decision-making capacity is all that important. Meaning, if a person is a patient, whether the person has decision-making capacity or not, isn't there an a priori obligation to treat the patient? In fact, what if a person refuses treatment? Would you say halachically that we would subscribe to the Federal Act of 1991 of self-determination, where a person in the United States, certainly America, the Self-Determination Act of 1991, where a person has the right to make autonomous decisions and they have a right to refuse treatments. A person has a right to refuse, let's say, blood transfusions. If they're of the a sect of J witnesses where they believe not in receiving blood because of the prohibition of the Torah of lo soflu dam, not to consume blood. They are of the opinion that that includes not only normal enteral methods of receiving blood, but also parenteral methods of receiving blood. So they are of the opinion, therefore they generally don't receive blood transfusions, with some exceptions and some modifications of that. So that's a religious reason. It's based on a religious precept. It's not based on some voices that told them not to. So a person has the right to refuse blood transfusions if they're of that religious persuasion, and that's autonomy, self-determination. And halacha, if somebody wanted to refuse a blood transfusion, we would assume that lahalacha, technically speaking offhand, a person doesn't have a right to refuse that. If it's indicated, it's not a question of a borderline hematocrit or hemoglobin, it's quite clear, not that they don't have any symptoms, they have symptoms of anemia and they have a low blood count and whatever it may be, and we would assume halachically they're obligated. That's a different question whether you would try to coerce such a patient. That's a different discussion. But certainly halachically we would say that the person doesn't have the right to refuse. That may be their final decision. Not everyone's decisions are always compatible with halacha. So the question is, why is decision-making capacity so important with halacha? In fact, it's interesting, just to reinforce that, one of the very premier poskim in Eretz Yisrael, former Sephardic chief rabbi, Rabbi Eliyahu Bakshi Doron, is a Shilas and Shuvas responsible literature called Binyan Av. So very fascinating, or actually Doron, one of the great Sephardic poskim in Eretz Yisrael. So he writes the following. He's talking about various forms of procedures. He talks about cosmetic and plastic surgeries. He talks about various surgeries that have certain significant risks. So he talks about the concept of Haskama Midas, about the person's own consent, the concept of informed consent, which is a basic tenet of bioethics in general throughout the world. So he writes the following, Mekubal Hayom, Shekol Tipul Rifli'i Kenituach Chodome, any kind of procedure, surgical or otherwise, Na'aseh Al Smach Daito Shel Rofei B'Haskamat HaCholef Okravot, requires obviously the physician to believe that it's indicated with the consent of the patient or a surrogate, a proxy, whatever it may be. As long as there is consent by a physician or family member or whoever the surrogate or proxy is. Ulami says, from a halakha perspective, barur, it is quite clear, from a halakha perspective, the permit, the right, the authorization to heal is totally independent of the patient's or family member's opinion. The only things that are significant are the halachas of pikuach nefesh, saving a person's life, the concept of protection of self-preservation of human health, and the potential perhaps to harm the person and cause involuntary manslaughter, if you will, and the sanctity of man. That's what he said. And he reinforces that in the next page in this, where he says, "Bevadai shelo dato shel hacholeh v'haskamato." It's clear that it's not the consent of the patient or his authorization or heim hakovim. It's not. It's just yesh banim. He says that there are times that the patient can override the physician who wishes not to treat, and the patient can override to treat. Classic example, Gemara has in Masechet Yoma, that on Yom Kippur, the doctor says the patient doesn't need to eat, and the patient feels that he or she needs to eat, so the patient oftentimes overrides the medical clinic. That's in a situation to treat, but not to treat. So the truth is that I'm not familiar with all of Rabbi Akshi Doron's opinion throughout, so I don't know whether this does or doesn't conform is, but the truth is that independently, there's certainly a very strong basis to say that that's not an absolute. As Dr. Steinberg himself writes, and it was referred to last night in Dr. Friedman's introduction to Dr. Steinberg, Dr. Steinberg won the Israel Prize a number of years ago for the encyclopedia that he put out, that Dr. Gerald Friedman talked about, the Encyclopedia Halachatit Rifuit. It's a 6 or 7 volume work in Hebrew, translated into, I think, 3 volumes by Dr. Rosner. So there he talks about the concept of autonomy, ikaron ha-autonomiya, and the one phrase that I think is important to mention here, achein tokfo shel erech ze lefi hashkafat halakha hi mugbal. I think that's perhaps a better, useful way to look at autonomy from a halachic perspective, namely, that from a Jewish perspective, autonomy is not absolute. It's mugbal. There exists a certain degree of self-determination and autonomy that a person has the right to execute and implement, but it's mukbal. It has its limitations. What those limitations are, there are wide diverse views as to what those limitations are, smaller or larger, but there certainly are limitations. And just to prove that to you, there are many sources, but just to prove you, Rishon Zalman Orbach was mentioned last night, so one of the fascinating, very unfortunate situations that Dr. Abraham, in his also classic work of Nishmat Avraham, describes from many years ago of an individual in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, who was suffering from ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a terminal condition. There is no cure for Lou Gehrig's disease. So it describes a situation with the patient asked Rav Eliashiv and Rishon Zalman about situations where when the person gets to a point, that at some point as the disease progresses neurologically, a person will lose their capacity to be able to ventilate, to be able to breathe on their own. And they will become ventilator dependent. Absolutely. That's the way the course of the disease goes. It was Senator Javits in New York who suffered from that as well. So there was a pitcher. Who was the pitcher? Lou Gehrig. But there was, right, there was a Lou Gehrig, but more recently there was a reliever, I think. There was a famous reliever, relief pitcher, who also suffered, I think, from ALS. So that he talks about this. Does the patient ask the Rishon Zalman of Eliashiv, does the person have to consent to being put on a ventilator at a time when they will no longer be able to maintain their own breathing respirator, which is a if you will, a terminal situation, meaning the person will never be able to be weaned off. The difficult shailas come up when a person will perhaps be on a ventilator, but it's not clear whether they would ever be able to be weaned off. This is clear. Once the person is on a ventilator in ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, they will never be able to be weaned off. So the question is, are they obligated? So both Rosh HaMazamin, and I think Rabbi Eliashiv also echoes the fact that a person is not obligated. A person can refuse that treatment. A person is not obligated to be on a ventilator for the rest of their lives in that kind of condition, necessarily. I'm not passing any halacha, I'm just presenting information purposes, but that's what they're right. So there is basis, and there are other big posts who also talk about the fact that a person does have a certain autonomy, self-determination. So from a halachic perspective, as I shift now to the third part of my presentation, it is important for us to know whether a patient has decision-making capacity, because they have to participate in the decision, either to override the physician or at times to be able to refuse treatment and be able to properly participate in their care. So how do we define decision-making capacity halachically? That's the last part of my presentation I'd like to focus on now for the remaining time. So the count I mentioned is a Gemara in Maseches Chagiga. It talks about a shote. The Gemara is defined, give three, like, if you will, symptoms of somebody who's a shotet. Somebody who, as Rabbi Farbstein talks about, somebody who's psychotic, but it could be for somebody who's also demented. What kind of things would present and manifest? The Gemara talks about, number one, yotze yechidi belaila. A person wanders out at night, all by him or herself, without any, if you will, goal-oriented. Person is in a very bad neighborhood, and they walk and wander around for hours and hours, kind of aimlessly, at night. Number two, example, is lon bebeis hakvaros. A person sleeps in the cemetery. And number three, korea begad. A person kind of rips their own clothes. They're kind of self-destructive. So I want to come back to that in just a few moments as I try to kind of formulate the idea of shote and das in halacha. So first of all, Dr. Abraham, also in his Sefer, says the following. Mikol ha'amur, he has a discussion about these issues. He says, from all that has been discussed, near eshigam hayom, efshar likvo klolim. It's not possible to establish definitive criteria. Almi nikra shoteh. Who's considered to be, if you will, lacking decision-making capacity, being psychotic, being demented in a way that is therefore exempt from its vote. He says it has to be glufi kviat ha'afchana meduyeket, proper evaluation by a physician, and as well as the halachic in import in terms of determining that. That being said, though, I'd like to kind of just focus on an idea that Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Farbstein of the Beis Din of Netanya and Rosh Kol of Imre David, I believe it's his wife, or Moshe Mordechai Epstein, I think his wife Esther Farbstein. His wife, I think Esther Farbstein, is a very viewed very, very, well, respected author, particularly in the kind of religious Haredi world. She's written some books related to the Holocaust, very, very important works. Esther Farbstein, I think that's his wife. So Moshe Mordechai Farbstein, you can find this on the medethics.org.il website. I think it was mentioned last night from the Falk Schlesinger Institute in Eretz Yisrael. So they have a wonderful website with many articles in Hebrew and in English as well. You'll find there are articles by Moshe Mordechai Farbstein in Hebrew as well as in English, and I have in the packet, if you want to look at the page 49, I have several pages of his Hebrew article, and then I think the first page of his English article about psychiatry and halacha, definition of shota, and you can look at that a little more leisurely when you have the opportunity, but I just want to kind of develop the idea that he does, which I think is a very well-developed idea of das, and that's what I'd like to focus on and conclude with this, defining das in halacha, having, if you will, proper cognitive or mental capacity. So he talks about the fact that there are two elements of defining das, and it is exactly those two middle elements that I referred to earlier, namely the concept of understanding and processing information and the ability to deliberate, evaluate, reason, and rationalize with that information, understanding the benefits, the risks, the consequences, alternatives. So he points out that according to the Noda B'Yehuda, Noda B'Yehuda has a very unique opinion which is not accepted by most poskim, as he points out, that it is possible for someone who's a shote, who is perhaps psychotic, who perhaps doesn't have rational thinking at the moment, to be able to effectively divorce his wife. Usually we assume that a shota, somebody who lacks proper cognitive abilities, is not only exempt from mitzvahs, but is not able to participate, can't serve as an aide, for example, can't be a witness under a chuppah, and can't affect certain very important consequences in halacha, can't affect a marriage, and can't affect a divorce. So note Yehuda's opinion, Yecheskel Landau's opinion is that if you have someone supervising him, if you have someone supervising and explaining that this is a get, and this is what you're doing, and this is what it is, and that, put it so that he will understand, he will have what he refers to as havana, understanding, he will be able to comprehend, So that person can divorce his wife. As long as the person has havanah, so that's what Rav Farbstein points out, according to Noda Yehuda, which is a minority opinion, he points out, das is defined as havanah, just understanding, just that second element of decision-making capacity. Doesn't have to fully understand that because of this, he will never be able to marry this woman again, let's say if he's a Kohen. Or because of this, they're not going to live. He doesn't necessarily understand the concept. Doesn't have to necessarily understand he has alternatives. Doesn't have to have this, if you will, greater insight into the process. Just has to understand what he's being told, understand what he's doing, understand that he's divorcing, handing the get to his wife, whatever it may be. That's all he just needs the das. And Farbstein points out that that is not the consensus, that the consensus of the poskim is that in addition to havanah, das also requires, as he refers to, the capacity of shiput, of being able to judge, to rationalize, to reason, to evaluate, to deliberate. And without that capacity, the person is considered to be a shota, a lav bar das, and therefore certainly cannot divorce his wife. And if you think about it, that idea of, as he talks about the concept of ratzon chopshi, totally freely willed decision. That's what we, just to come back to and conclude, talk about an authentic choice. A person who understands what they're doing doesn't necessarily translate into making an authentic choice. They may understand it, and without kind of reflexively, or perhaps impulsively, or perhaps instinctively do those, doesn't mean that they have a greater insight, like Bilam, Yodea Das Elyon, to have greater insight. The person doesn't have full insight. The person doesn't understand all the consequences, the alternatives of what he's doing by divorcing his wife. So that lack of insight, that lack of Das that he talks about, that lack of, if you will, Shiput, the ability to evaluate, means that it's not a Ritzon Chavshi, it's not a truly free-willed or authentic decision. And if you think about it, just to conclude, if you look at the examples that the Gemara gives about somebody who's a Shota, I think that all three of them express this idea. Somebody who's Yotze Yechidi Belaila. Somebody who wanders out. And then it could be somebody who has dementia. That's certainly possible. But if you think about it, the person may know for a while that they're walking around the street. They may know the information, what they're doing, but they don't have any goal orientation, and they don't realize the dangers that they're placing themselves in the neighborhood that they're walking around. They're just wandering around aimlessly, meaning that they're not using judgment. They're not using shiput. They're not rationalizing the reasoning. They may understand, yeah, I was taking a walk, and it was this and that, and did they fully understand that it was 3 o'clock in the morning and where they were going? So that's a lack of shiput, of, if you will, ratzon chavshi, korea begadav, somebody who just rips their clothes kind of aimlessly without any purpose, just kind of destroying their own property. They know what they're doing. Yeah, I was ripping my clothes, but they understand the consequences of what that means. It's a lack of shiput. Again, in Lung Bay Sakbar, a person sleeps in the cemetery, they may say, it's very comfortable here, it's very quiet, very peaceful, it's very serene, yeah, absolutely. But they don't understand that is so, if you will, not conformant with normal social behavior, normal social activities, and that it's considered to be, even if it's not dangerous, it's certainly not considered something that is reasonable to do. And so I think the Gemara emphasizes this notion that he develops, namely that das in halacha, decision-making capacity, requires a person to not only be able to understand and process, but to be able to use judgment, rationalize, reason, to have insight. And without that, the person will be considered lav bar das and a shote in whatever situation, whatever applications, whatever all of the halachic implications are. Thank you very much.
You can take a few minutes of questions if anybody would like. Any questions? Let me just, you know, briefly ask you, what about a child? Decision making.
So part of that I think we're going to defer to Dr. Friedman, but yes, there is a category of halacha, not of a shota.
Who is decision maker for the child.
Oh, but a katan, a minor, is considered halakhically not to have das as well, similar to shota, but for different reasons. That's a halakhic, even though they can have habana, they can have understanding, but perhaps their judgment is not yet mature enough, so that may be why they're up. So who makes decisions? So we generally assume there are discussions about that, about basically it's parents who make decisions. There is a tshuva, I don't remember the specifics, the Melamed Lehoel, Reb David Tzvi Hoffman, has a tshuva where he talks about, I think, a situation where parents did not want to provide treatment, I think, for a child. Like, for example, it's not uncommon with parents who subscribe to Christian Scientist religious beliefs and don't want to provide certain what's considered to be conventional treatments for the children. So he has a tshuva about that, whether parents have the right to do so or not. So I think we generally assume that parents have the right and the responsibility to make decisions for their children to the extent that they are, of course, rational and reasonable. Otherwise, not. So it basically would be, in a sense, a surrogate because of the responsibility and obligation and privilege of parents to do so. Ramosha, in one of his tshuvas, talks about if a patient doesn't have the ability to express their opinions, that he often says sometimes the family can, because we assume that the family has a greater insight as to what the patient would or would not want. Yes?
I have a question. Are you dealing with someone with diminished capacity? But I would like to suggest to you that those of us who may not have diminished capacity can nevertheless never give informed consent when it comes to bio procedures that we have to do. We can't do informed consent because we don't know anything. We don't know nearly enough to make decisions in an informed capacity. That we may have habana, but we certainly don't have shifut. And most of the time, I wind up asking my doctor and saying, well, if I were your son, what would you suggest I do? So, I mean, this notion of authentic decision seems to me to be like fiction. I mean, you'll get a decision, but authentic, I don't even know what authentic really means. Freely willed, I'm not even sure it's freely willed, because the system, in a certain sense, coerces you by virtue of the system to do certain things. Opting out is irrational. Opting out is exactly what you say indicates, you know, that you don't have proper capacity. So I'm just wondering whether this notion is just...
Right. Okay. So the point you make is well taken. I would suggest that it's not a question whether the person has decision-making capacity. The question is whether it is properly being, if you will, played out or executed, and whether on the part of healthcare workers, whether the proper procedure to be able to facilitate decision-making is being implemented or not. In some situations, I think it is quite clear where sometimes the physician goes into the room, just says sign here and doesn't explain all of the consequences, tells them to read. Yes, but oftentimes it is not like that. Oftentimes patients have, I think, a greater and deeper appreciation of what's going on with the physician or whoever it may be. Some healthcare, whether it's a nurse, a physician, a resident, or whatever, explaining as fully and as reasonable as possible to make decisions. That is, in a sense, how we make decisions through life. Always, until we've experienced something, we don't have a full, profound appreciation, but we have enough to be able to make a reasonable, reasoned decision. So when properly informed, which you're right, doesn't always happen, that's not, I think, a deficiency in the concept of decision-making capacity, it's a deficiency in the process of facilitating that, and as such, if properly done, a patient can have a greater and fuller appreciation of the process and be able to give what is considered to be a reasonable, informed consent. Angioplasty, I think, first of all, it would certainly be appropriate, you can show a patient a film of an angioplasty. There are centers that before a person undergoes cardiothoracic surgery, they will have films of what this process, what the procedure, surgery is like. And if they don't pass out in the middle of the video, then they will have greater appreciation of it. So I think it does require effort. Your point is well taken. It requires, if you will, a concerted effort to properly implement. Just but parenthetically, you mentioned about deferring to the patient. You know the story about Winston Churchill, where one of the members of Parliament, a woman, said to him that if you were my husband, I would poison your tea, to which he responded, if you were my wife, I would drink it. So, so deferring, talking about deferring decisions. So. Okay. Yes.
Most of the doctors who were doing that believed that they were doing the right thing. This was not people doing it
just you want people who do just to make an extra buck. But the science at the time was saying, the studies at the time were saying, hey, this gives a better outcome. And now we've done, that's been done. The same with the hormone replacement, the women's health study. We believed that we did, you know, this to people for years and years. We thought we knew what we were doing, but we really didn't. So even our knowledge, so then that brings up give the patient have this capacity, and the patient's supposed to exercise this capacity. This capacity, to what extent do we have to go to inform the patient? And since we don't even know, in many cases, we believe we know, but we've been proven wrong so many times. And where's the boundary?
Right.
What I'm asking is, where's the boundary?
So I think a partial answer to your question is what the Gemara sometimes talks about, Posen talks about, that sometimes when the first, what's considered to be the consensus, what's considered to be the normative, what's considered to be, if you will, kind of the standard of treatment, I think is a good way to look at it. So we can only make decisions with information that we have. We're not expected, again, to rely on baskols, if you will, information that's not necessarily accessible to us. So it's correct. What is considered to be a reasonable decision in 1 year may not be considered, but that doesn't in any way, I think, mitigate the fact that it was a reasonable decision then, that at that time this was considered to be the standard of treatment. There's a whole host of examples in that, whether it's medications, whether it's treatments, whether it's modalities, whether it's in the field of psychology and psychiatry, different modalities that are considered to be more or less effective in a particular patient, what's considered to be all kinds of, which, so it, I think it's based on what's considered to be reasonable. That's why I also mentioned that in terms of evaluating the decision-making capacity of the patient, the healthcare provider also, in a sense, uses their own judgment to determine that and uses, therefore, information that is perhaps, if you will, subjective on some level because it's based on research of many centers that right now is considered to be the prevailing view. Halakha doesn't require us to know everything. Halakha requires us to, if you will, do what is considered to be normative and consensus-based, if you will, evidence-based to some extent. And with that, sometimes the decision will say, but the process is still a valid process. Thank you.
You know, we'll take questions after, but we decided to, in this unit, as you can hear already, we're going to have the speaker and the questions instead of, I know, the schedule, the questions all at the end. If we have time at the end, we'll have, you know, more questions. But I just want to give each of the speakers sort of equal opportunity.